Psalm 33 is a great reading, dovetails right into what we're talking about this morning in Isaiah 6. Isaiah 6, you can follow along in your Bible in Isaiah 6. There's a pew Bible right in front of you, the black book there, and it's page 680. If you want to follow along, it'll be page 680. I want to talk this morning about what it means as a church and as individuals to be a faithful witness in a world of indifference. Or we in Peter, we're calling it a faithful witness in a world of unbelief. Now, when you hear the word unbelief, we're of course talking about a range and a scale there. Just to throw this out, I think we could say there are maybe three different types or three levels of unbelief. I realize all unbelief is unbelief, but when it comes to interacting in the community and in the world that we live in today, we might say that there's a range of maybe three different things. The first one I think we call cordial unbelief. What do I mean by cordial unbelief? This is where the world doesn't believe the gospel, but appreciates some things that the gospel might produce. So we might know people that would say, I don't believe the gospel, but part of me wishes that I did. Or I'm way too much of a person of science to have your kind of faith, but boy, I wish I had that kind of faith. Or maybe they think it's really good for kids to go to Sunday school because they can get some good character lessons and learn about God and things like that, even though they themselves don't attend or are not part of a faith community. So in some way, cordial belief says that the gospel or Christianity contributes to the public good in some way, shape, or form. And this is probably the culture in the United States 50 years ago. The second level we might call indifference. Faith in God is not good and it's not bad. Or it's good for some people, but probably not good for all people. And nobody here is opposing the gospel, at least overtly, just a lot of indifference. And we're going to see that Isaiah is talking to this kind of audience. Not a cordial audience, not a hostile audience, but a very kind of indifference, going to fall on deaf ears kind of audience. And a third level, we might say, is hostility. When you read the letters of Paul and you read the letters of Peter, that's where the hostility really comes out. And in a hostile idea, the church is actually in the way of sociological progress. Christianity is in the way of society's progress. Society would be better off if there was no Christianity at all. And a good part of the New Testament was written against that background. So I think if you did a survey all the way from Genesis to the book of Revelation, and you did a bit of a historical survey, you'd find at least these three categories. There are times when you find yourself in a very cordial world, where they appreciate some things that you do. There's times you find yourself in a very indifferent world. People really don't care what you think, but they're not opposing it per se. And then there's the extreme of hostility, which is taking place right now on the other side of the world with our brothers and sisters in Christ. And I will add one more thought before we talk about Isaiah. As certainly as in the biblical cultures, cultures can oscillate between these a little bit. There's times when we see a culture very cordial, and then 50 years later in the Bible, it shifts, which we see in Isaiah. It shifts towards indifference and hostility. The same thing can happen in our world today. There are cultures that 50 years ago were extremely hostile towards Christianity that now are borderline cordial. Where before, to even plant the church would be against the law, and now those people and those cultures are kind of embracing, at least culturally, some of the things that come with embracing the gospel. And then we have some cultures 50 years ago that were very cordial that are now very hostile. So things can oscillate. We want to recognize that. We don't want to put every idea of unbelief in the same category. Now, the reason this is important for us as we look towards the book of Isaiah is this. Isaiah is writing on the front end of a culture shift. It's the front end of a culture shift. He's writing on a culture shift that is going from cordial and kind of shifting over towards indifferent. When Isaiah 6 opens up by saying that in the year King Uzziah died, that means nothing to us, right? But it means everything in Isaiah's day. If we read about King Uzziah in the Bible, we would see that he was one of the better kings. He was one that did a lot for the infrastructure of Israel. He also did a lot religiously for Israel. Towards the end of his life, he took a terrible downturn, and that's the culture shift that we're seeing. But Uzziah represents some kind of cordial warmth towards the promises of God. 1 Kings 15:3 says, Uzziah did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. That is the trend of the time. There is a cordial feel between the promises of God and the days of King Uzziah. In other words, when the prophet Isaiah first starts his ministry and he starts preaching, most people are okay with that, even if they don't believe it. They're not indifferent, they're not hostile, they may even be a little bit intrigued by it. But when we read King Uzziah died, what that means in history is that a culture shift has taken place, and now we're going from cordial, now we're shifting over to indifferent. And if you want to see it, look at the end of the chapter. We're going to read these verses again in a little bit, but look at verse 9. And he said, go, tell this people, be hearing, but never understanding. Be ever seeing, but never perceiving. Make the heart of this people callous, make their ears dull, and they close their eyes. Otherwise they might see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and turn to the Lord and be healed. You see what's happening? There's a culture shift taking place. We're going from cordial, at least on the surface, open to what Isaiah's preaching is, and there's going to be a shift, and there's going to be a radical indifference in the land. Eventually, it's going to turn a little bit hostile. But Isaiah here is describing some kind of indifference. So in Isaiah, what God is doing in chapter 6, he is preparing the prophet, and frankly the remnant of Israel, for how to be a faithful witness in this world of indifference. And I think there's some things we can draw for ourselves right here at Ridgefield Baptist, right in Fairfield County. What does it mean for us as a church to be a faithful witness in perhaps a world of indifference? I'll give you three things, okay? And we'll tease these out as we go. And the first one is this. We find strength to be a faithful witness in God's redeeming love. In God's redeeming love. Going to pick up where we left off last week, but let me remind you, there are two major themes in Isaiah 6. The sovereignty of God and the redemptive love of God. In the first four verses, Isaiah looks up and he gets this vision of the glory and the holiness of God, so much so that the posts begin to tremble before God. It's a picture of sovereignty. And every single word in those first four verses just points towards the sovereignty of God. I mean, you have angels, the literally burning ones, who are hiding their face from an even greater burning one. And they're covering their feet in humility. And Isaiah here is before God, looking at the holiness of God. This is a picture of the sovereignty of God. And this is God's way of telling Isaiah, you are in a world of indifference. And you're really insecure about that, but make no mistake of it, I'm in control of the affairs of this world. So the sovereignty of God. The second thing we see, though, and I want to touch on this today, is the redemptive love of God. Look at verse 5. Woe to me, I cried, I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. And one of the seraphs flew with me, a live coal in his hand, which he had taken from the tongs of the altar. With it he touched my mouth and said, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away from you, and your sin is atoned for. So notice here, this is a picture of redemption. In fact, I think we could say this. There are three pictures, all of which relate to the idea of redemption in this passage. There's a picture of sin. There's a picture of conviction. And there's a picture of God's grace. So let's talk about these three for a minute as we unpack this picture of redemption. Now, let me introduce you to a topic here that commentators like to kick around, and it's this. In most places in the Bible, somebody gets a vision, and then they go out and minister, but the book of Isaiah is slightly disorganized. Isaiah gets a vision of God, but he doesn't include that until chapter 6. Why does he do this? Because if we're reading the book of Ezekiel, here's what we'd see. Vision of God? Now you go minister to the people, Ezekiel. How about the book of Revelation? You're familiar with Revelation. What happens in the beginning of the book? John gets a vision of God, and then he goes out and prophesies to the churches and to the nations. The book of Isaiah is intentionally disorganized. Why? Why does chapter 6 come after chapter 5 when chronologically it probably should be chapter 1? Well, I'll give you what I think is going on here, okay? And it has to do with where Isaiah puts it and Isaiah seeing his sinfulness before God. Back up to chapter 5. We're going to get a running start, okay? We could spend weeks in chapter 5. We're going to do it in about 120 seconds. So stick with me. In chapter 5, Isaiah shows that God planted a vineyard. That vineyard, of course, is Israel. And then he moves to courtroom language in chapter 3. He says, "You dwellers of Jerusalem, of Judea, judge, judge between me and my vineyard." Verse 4, "What more could I have done for the vineyard? I've done all these things for the vineyard, and yet the vineyard is still turned away from me." In other words, God has poured out his blessing on Israel, and Israel has still turned away from God. Now we go into what's called the woe section of Isaiah 5. Isaiah kicks out six woes against Israel and against the world. He has his finger, this is important, he has his finger pointed at the community and at the world saying, "Woe is you." Hey, look at him. For example, verse 8 and 9, "Woe against covetousness. Woe unto you that add house to house and join field to field. You extend your borders. In the meantime, you're running everybody over to do that." Covetousness. "Woe unto those that have excess with substance." Verse 11 through 17. "Woe unto those who rise up early in the morning and run after their drinks, who stay up late at night till they are inflamed with wine." You see that? They're so caught up with excess and substance. Isaiah says, "Woe unto you." This is the kind of community that's under the wrath and the judgment of God. "Woe unto those that defy God." Verse 18. "Woe unto those who draw sin along with cords of deceit and wickedness as cart ropes." Now, what in the world does that mean? Horace Mann said this, and I think it makes sense of verse 18. He said, "Habit is cable. We've a thread of it each day, and finally it binds us." And what Horace Mann is saying about education is this, is that if you want to form a habit, do a little thread of it, then another thread, then another thread, and before you know it, you have an actual cord in your hand that can't be broken. Isaiah is kind of using that picture here of rope or a cord, that they have cultivated very wicked habits before God, injustice, oppression, things like that, and now it's become a cord. It's a habit. It's built into the fabric of who they are as a people. "Woe unto against perversity," verse 20. "Woe unto those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness." Verse 21, he gives a woe to self-sufficiency. And then here comes the big one. "Woe unto unjust rulers," verse 22. "Woe unto those who are heroes at drinking wine, champions at mixing drinks, who acquit the guilty for a bribe but deny justice to the innocent." So the problem in this passage is they go out and they do a lot of partying and they end up losing their senses and they don't judge very well. While people are bringing court cases before these rulers and while they're trying to judge matters in the community, they're inebriated, they're drunk, they're all up on substance, and therefore they have an inability to hand down a proper judgment. And so the poor become more oppressed and the rich just get richer and richer. They have essentially turned the political system into a big party. Now, why is this important for us? Let's tie it all together. Six times Isaiah says, "Woe is you, woe is you, woe is you." Now look at Isaiah 6:5. "Woe is me, for I am undone. For I am a man of unclean lips." You know what Isaiah is doing in chapter 6? You know why he didn't put this in chapter 1? Because Isaiah has just spent most of his time pointing a finger at the community, condemning them. And then he sees a vision of who God is. And he points a finger right back at himself in humility. And says, "As certainly as the world has turned away from God, I've done the exact same thing." Isaiah 6:5 is the seventh woe of Isaiah. And where he's in a habit of calling everybody else around him a big sinner, when he sees God, He sees the big sinner is not so much the world. The big sinner is Isaiah himself. He's moved with humility. And that's what a vision of God does for a faithful witness in a church. Where it's not about pointing to people on the outside. It's not about calling the world evil and launching hand grenades over the bunker. It's about a little introspection, looking at our own hearts and seeing that we as God's people, we who claim to know Him, we break just as many laws. We, our hearts are probably running just as fast and as furious from God. And this word woe is powerful. He's pronouncing doom upon himself. This is not one of those, woe is me, I'm having a bad day. This is a message of doom. So Isaiah, after announcing a message of doom on the world, announces an even bigger message of doom about himself. So let me give you a couple of thoughts just about what Christians call sin here in this passage. Let me give you two thoughts. We could spend a lot of time. I'll give you two thoughts. Number one is this, and I had a group that talked about this week. That's why it's fresh on my mind. One of the things you see in Isaiah 5, when he's announcing all these dooms, and then on himself, sin is disordered loves. And that's Augustine's definition of sin. A lot of us believe that sin is when you do bad things, but Augustine would tell us, sin is not so much doing bad things, sin is taking a good thing and making it the supreme thing. It's taking a good thing and making it the supreme thing, and that's essentially what they're doing in Isaiah chapter 5. They're taking good things and making them the supreme things. Anything wrong with expanding your borders? Anything at all wrong with that? You know what the prayer of Jabez is? In the prayer of Jabez, he prays for expanded borders. There's really nothing wrong with expanded borders. But when a good thing is the supreme thing, then you start to run over your neighbors. Anything wrong with nationalism? Anything wrong with appreciating the country in which you were born or maybe immigrated to or a part of? There's nothing wrong with that. That's a good thing. But when a good thing becomes a supreme thing, then we have World War II. Anything wrong with wine? Biblically, no. It's a good thing on the sixth day, right? God pronounced these things good. But when a good thing becomes the supreme thing, we have drunk driving. See, Augustine's definition of sin is not that we're all running around doing bad things. We're making good things the most important thing. Augustine said this. He called these disordered loves. When you get your loves out of order, when you love stuff more than God, the creation more than the Creator, and even more than people created in God's image. Augustine said this, but living a just and holy life requires one to be capable of an objective, impartial evaluation of things, to love things, that is to say, in the right order, so that you do not love what is not to be loved, or fail to love what is to be loved, or have a greater love for what should be loved less, or an equal love for things that should be loved less. And he goes on and on with this tough language to follow. But his point is this. Disordered loves is when we love good things in a supreme way. Let me ask you a question, teenagers. Is it a good thing to love your friends? Yeah, read the Proverbs. It's great. But when you make a good thing the supreme thing, that's when we're wandering outside of God's perfect will. Is it a good thing? Sex and health? Is career a good thing? Absolutely. Genesis 2 tells us that God created us to work. It's a really good thing to cultivate the garden. Maybe in your business it's insurance or something like that. It's a good thing to cultivate the ground, to cultivate the culture, to bring order out of chaos. But when we make a good thing, like our career, the supreme thing, that's when we have our loves out of order. And that's when a society is out of order. You see, what Isaiah does is he looks around his world and he looks at all the disordered loves, how people are making an idol out of career, an idol out of wine, an idol out of their business and expanding their borders. And then Isaiah 6:5, he looks at his own heart and says, my loves are just as disordered. I'm no better than anybody I'm looking at. I think Paul, if he was writing Isaiah 6, would say something like, I am the chief of sinners. When you get a vision of who God is as a church and as a people, It causes us not to look out and confess the sins of everybody else. It causes us to look into our own hearts and evaluate where they are before God and see that our loves are just as disordered, maybe in different ways, but just as disordered as the world around us. When Isaiah says, "Woe is me," and man, we got a lot packed into this word woe, but he's at least saying this. He's at least saying, my potential for evil is far greater than I ever thought. It's not that full-blown tree that I'm looking at in the world, but man, I got the acorns in my heart. It's Romans 3, right? All have sinned. Isaiah looked at the blossom tree of evil in the nation of Israel, and he soon discovers he's actually a part of that. Disordered lust. Chuck Colson wrote a book called Being the Body, and he tells a little story about mass murderer from a Nazi mass murderer, Adolf Eichmann. Eichmann, after World War II, was kidnapped in 1960 by Israeli agents and put on trial in Israel. And one witness against him was an Auschwitz survivor, Yehiel Dinur. Yehiel Dinur. And Colson talks about when Dinur actually entered the courtroom. He entered the courtroom, and you got to remember, this is a man that has been through Auschwitz, one of the worst tragedies in modern times. He said the courtroom, that he stared at Eichmann and their eyes met. After a few tension-filled moments, Dinur broke down and began to shout and began to sob. He walks in, he sees Eichmann, the man who terribly oppressed him and his people and his family. He holds the eye for a few minutes, and then he begins to sob. "Why?" asked Chuck Colson. "Was it the memories of Auschwitz? Was Eichmann evil incarnate?" "No." Dinur later explained on 60 Minutes, when he looked up at the stand, he noticed for the first time that Eichmann was an ordinary man. Dinur saw clearly that sin and evil are not just up there on the stand, but they're part of the broader human condition. And Dinur says, "I was afraid of myself. I saw that I am capable of doing this, that there's a little bit of Eichmann in each one of us." And I think Isaiah is feeling something similar as Isaiah looks out into the world and sees all the sin and all the evil and all the injustice. He realizes that there's a lot more of that in his heart and a lot more of that in his life than he first thought. It's a great author, Solzhenitsyn, who said something like, "The line separating good and evil does not run through political parties. It does not run through the political process, but it oscillates right there within the human heart." I think there's something similar going on here. Six times he points at the world. "You are the problem of the world. You are the problem of the world. You are the problem of the world." And then he sees God, and he falls down before God and says, "Woe is me. I am the same part of this human condition as everybody else that I've been condemning." You see why chapter 6 has to go here instead of chapter 1? Because Isaiah is trying to show that the same world he's pointing a finger at, he is also a part of. And so it is. Evil does not oscillate through the political parties. It does not oscillate through classes. It does not oscillate through races. It oscillates right here in the human heart. Solzhenitsyn's on the money. So what is sin? Sin is disordered loves. What is conviction? I love this phrase in verse 5. I actually like the old translation better. It says, "I am ruined." I like this old King James. It says, "I am undone." I am undone. I'm not sure there's an English word that accurately grabs this idea, but it means to rip apart at the seams. So you got to picture this. Isaiah is standing before God. He gets a vision of the holiness of God, and he's saying, "I just disintegrated before him." You know, think about a garment that's being ripped that kind of comes apart at the seams. That's the idea when he says, "I am ruined, I am undone." I think psychologists call this personal disintegration. And what's interesting is Isaiah is a man that you would think had everything together. You would think Isaiah is the most righteous of the prophets in the land. Remember, Isaiah is not one of these ground-up prophets. There are prophets and there are deliverers in Israel that kind of rise out of the ashes. You know, Jephthah in the book of Judges rises out of the ashes. Jephthah basically ran a gang. He ran a street gang. and God turned him into one of the great deliverers of Israel. And so we look at a guy like Jephthah and we say, yeah, I can see why he's undone and he's ruined before God. He may have cleaned himself up, but come on, look at him. Isaiah is the prophet of prophets. Isaiah ran in the nobility even before he was called to be a prophet. Isaiah is a guy that we think has it all together, and when he looks at God, he says, I am undone. He disintegrates before God and realizes that he is broken and he is in need of salvation just like the rest of the world. You want to know what conviction is? Conviction, in some ways, is the dismantling of self-righteousness. That's what it is. When God convicts our hearts, he's not just showing us, wow, we're very sinful, we need to be saved. What's he doing? He is, in some ways, dismantling our self-righteousness. One of the great books that I've read in the last year is R.C. Sproul's Holiness. If you haven't read it, oh, fantastic. And he's got a section on Isaiah 6. Now listen to what he says here. He's got a way with words. If ever there was a man of integrity, it was Isaiah. He was a whole man, a together type of fellow, considered by his contemporaries to be the most righteous in a nation, respected as a paragon of virtue. Then he caught one glimpse of a holy God. In a single moment, all of his self-esteem was shattered. In a brief second, he was exposed, made naked before the gaze of an absolute standard of holiness. As long as Isaiah could compare himself to other mortals, chapter 5, he was able to sustain a lofty opinion of his own character. The instant he measured himself against the ultimate standard, he was destroyed, morally and spiritually annihilated. He was undone, come apart. A sense of integrity had collapsed. What is R.C. Sproul saying? He's saying that Isaiah, before the world, is a really good person, but Isaiah, in front of God, is just as broken as everybody else. Now here comes a picture of redemption. Look at verse 6 and 7. One of the seraphs flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. Now the altar here, we're reminded that the altar is probably tabernacle temple language. And so the altar is where they would make these sacrifices to atone for sin. So there's a picture of forgiveness coming already. With it, he touched my lips and said, see, this has touched your lips. Think about the burning that would happen on Isaiah's lips, the pain. There's a real pain in coming to grips with who he really is, but it's going to be so liberating and so freeing. Your guilt is taken away from you and your sin is atoned for. Now I want to stop and think about the flow of this passage. God starts off by showing Isaiah that he is the creator and sovereign of all. He is the creator of all. And then he shows right here that he is also ready to forgive. He is supremely sovereign, and yet he loves supremely. He's the maker and the redeemer. And that's what motivates Isaiah to live by faith in a secular world. There's an old story I love. It's about a little boy who lived near one of the Great Lakes, small city near the Great Lakes. And he and his father spent a lot of time, several months, making a beautiful little model boat. And he goes off and he puts it in the water, and day after day, that was his pride and joy. And the boat would kind of float out and the current would bring it back. But one day he went out and put the boat in the water, and the boat just kept floating off. It caught a gust of wind. The tiny boat carried way out into the lake, far further than the boy could even see. The little boy, who took such pride in his boat, was distraught, understandably. He returned home, inconsolable. Day after day, he'd walk back to the shore and look out into the water, hoping that he'd find that boat coming back, or maybe just adrift there on one of the rocks. And then one day came, he was walking through town, and he passed by the local pawn shop. And there in the window is the boat. He, of course, runs in and tells the shop owner, that's the boat I made. But the shop owner has to break the news to him that I actually own that boat. I bought it from a local fisherman who brought it in. So the young boy sets himself at work to do anything he can to raise enough money for the boat. Day after day, week after week, he puts his fingers to anything he can do to make money to buy back that little boat. And finally, the day comes when he has enough money and he goes to the store and he buys the boat. He walks out of the shop with the boat under his arm. He's now the proud owner of that boat. And with an ear-to-ear grin on his face, he looks down at that little boat and he says, "I made you and I bought you. You are doubly mine." And Isaiah is saying the same thing. I made you. I am the God of all. And I bought you. You are doubly mine. You know, if we're going to be a faithful witness in the world of indifference, you have to believe both of these. You can't believe one at the expense of the other. We've talked about this at Ridgefield Baptist. Here's why. If we believe God is sovereign, but we don't believe he's loving, we've just turned ourselves into deists. If we believe God is loving, but we don't believe he's sovereign, we're a secular church. We have to believe both of these. I do not believe that we can live by faith and be a faithful witness before a deistic God. You want to know why? I don't think he cares. Why am I going to be faithful to someone that doesn't care about me or the world? I have to know that he loves me. I can't just know he's in control. At the same time, the secular God, loving but not in control, that doesn't exactly inspire us to be faithful witnesses either. Yeah, he really, really loves me, but in the back of my mind I'm thinking, is he really going to be able to pull this plan off? I mean, this whole redeem the world thing's a pretty big call, you know? It's not enough for God just to love us. We got to know that he's in control of our lives and in control of the events of the world. So what Isaiah does is marvelous. He says, I am in control. I am the sovereign. Look at me on the throne. Now look at how I love you and redeem you. You are doubly mine. So we reject the God of deism, we reject the God of secularism, and we find ourselves looking to a very loving, very powerful God. That's the kind of God I can live for. That's the kind of God we can live for. That's the kind of God we can be a faithful witness, even in a world of indifference. Anything less than that does not inspire me to do much. I want to move real quick through. In fact, I'll come back to that next week. Let me pull to my last slide, if you don't mind, Keith. I want to read these verses for a minute, verse 13 through 19, to finish our text. Go and tell this people, and here's the indifference, be ever hearing but never understanding. Be ever seeing but never perceiving. Make the heart of this people callous, make their ears dull, and close their eyes. Otherwise they might see with their eyes and hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and turn and be healed. Then I said, for how long, O Lord? And he answered, until the cities lie in ruin and without inhabitant, until the houses are left deserted, fields ruined and ravaged, until the Lord has sent everyone far away and the land is utterly forsaken. And though a tenth remain in the land, it will be laid waste again. But as the terebinth and the oak leaf stumps when they are cut down, so the holy seed will be a stump in the land. What Isaiah is saying is this: we're going to preach a gospel to a very indifferent world. And though it's going to look like, it's even going to look like the whole world is rejecting, it's actually not the case. There's going to be a stump that remains. That stump is what we know in the Old Testament is the remnant. If we're reading Ezekiel, what Ezekiel did to signify this is he cut all his hair. He cut his hair off, and he threw some in the fire, he threw some in the wind, and then he took a little bit and tucked it into his belt. That's a picture of the remnant. That's the stump. So God, with or without people, is going to fulfill his plan here. There will be a stump. There will be a Messiah. Later on in the book of Isaiah, we learn that Jesus is the what? Branch. You see the language coming out here? There's a stump here out of which someday there's going to be a branch. Now, why is this important? Here's why. In order to be a faithful witness, we persevere through grace alone. You say, where do you get that? Here's the thing. When God gets a hold of your heart like he does Isaiah's, you start to think that the only reason the rest of the world doesn't believe is because they don't have all the information. That's what you start to think. You start to think, if I just clarify things a little bit, I mean, come on, he's on the throne. He burned my lips and forgave my sins. He is having such an experience with God, he cannot understand why the rest of the world would not want to experience this. That's Isaiah's heart here. But Isaiah has got to have some realistic expectations. And so God gives him this passage and says, the message that you're preaching is going to fall on some deaf ears. Not all, but some deaf ears. Now, I know what you're thinking, you that are really in tune with Scripture. You're saying, yeah, but this is Old Testament. In the New Testament, it doesn't fall on deaf ears. And I would say the passage I just read is one of the most quoted verses in the New Testament. All the Gospels have these verses, and Paul actually closes the book of Acts with these verses. And so what the New Testament is telling us, and Isaiah here, is that a lot of the message that we preach of the gospel is going to fall on some deaf ears. You know what we have visions of? We have visions of grand revival all the time. You know, one person will come to Jesus, then another person, then the whole world is going to be transformed, and then all of it. Yeah, that's going to happen, but it's not going to happen until Jesus returns. Between now and then, Isaiah gets a reasonable expectation of what the world is going to look like. And here's where I want to go with this and just close with this thought. The message that's going to fall on deaf ears does not mean there's a problem with Isaiah's commitment. And it doesn't even mean there's a problem with Isaiah's methods. Nor does it mean there's a problem with the message itself. Isaiah puts the blame where it should go. The blame is the heart. My heart. Your heart. All of our hearts. Why do I say this? Because when you're trying to be a faithful witness in a world of indifference, and visions of revival don't come to pass, the first thing you do is question your own commitment. That's what every one of us does. Especially if it's your own family or people that are close to you. You start saying, maybe they're not seeing what I'm seeing because I'm not committed enough. I'm not praying enough. All of which may be true. But in reality, the problem is not with Isaiah's commitment. He's thoroughly committed. And yet it's still kind of an indifferent world. Once you run through the commitment level, level two is usually the method level, right? Well, the problem is we're not contextualizing enough. The problem is our methods aren't right. If we change our method, it'll reach the world. Again, that very well may be true. Paul talked a lot about being all people to all men. He talked about how he gave up pay in order to promote the gospel because that was best. Timothy in Acts 16 was willing to be circumcised. That's painful. Circumcised as an adult so that the gospel would go out with more power. The Bible talks a lot about the importance of reevaluating our methods. I get all that. And yet the problem here is not with Isaiah's commitment. And in this text, the problem is it's not with the method either. It's not that Isaiah is not reaching out. He's not loving people. It's not that he's not contextualizing and telling the right stories. It's not that the sermon's too short, sermon's too long, didn't sing the right songs, right? It's the heart here. And when all else fails, when you're trying to be a faithful witness, and you realize, well, it's probably not my commitment, and I've tried all these new methods, then we go and we usually try to alter the message. And we start editing out the gospel a little bit. And we do away with the nuisance doctrines that maybe are a little bit offensive. And the nuisance doctrines are going to change place to place. But all this to say, the stump here not only represents the promise to Israel, but the promise to the world. And the ears here are very deaf. The deaf ears are not a sign that something's wrong with Isaiah. It's not a sign that he's not carrying the message well. And it's certainly not a sign that the message is flawed in any way, shape, or form. What God is showing Isaiah is that it's not about you manipulating people to bring them to faith. It's about my grace working in people's hearts and lives. We ought to look at the world of indifference, not just as this big obstacle God can't get over because he can. It ought to push us more and more towards away from trusting ourselves and more towards trusting God. That he's the only one that can change our hearts. He's the only one that can change people's hearts. We have two choices. People are either indifferent, including us in our own stubbornness, because we're not really doing a great job, again, it's possible, or it's grace alone, and God is the one that's going to change hearts and change lives. Sometimes I think churches and even individuals take way, way more of a burden than God wants us to carry. Salvation, ultimately, is of the Lord, Jonah says, and not of us.